Hello, everyone. Welcome to another binary episode of the Day Zero podcast. I'm Spectre, with me is Z. As a heads up, next week will be our last episodes of the podcast until September 25th and 26th when we return from our summer break. We're still planning to have some content out during the summer break, but not the regularly scheduled streams. On that note, we are also planning to hit DEF CON during the summer, and Z is looking to make some Spot the Ballin shirts. So if you have some ideas or favorite Spot the Ballins that you think would be good for that, or if you'd be looking to like pick up such a shirt and meet up with us at the conference, head over to our Discord and leave your thoughts in there. And on the topic of Spot the Ballin, I'll pass it over to Z here for that.
Yeah, or go ahead and DM me if you have a favorite Spot the Ballin. I mean, it's just a shirt with the Ballin on it, really. Probably our Zero logo too, but they're nice for like I guess conversation starters with other people. I know we both had a couple shirts like that some years ago, and I definitely got into a few conversations with people trying to solve it.
Definitely when you're in the line con, yeah.
Yeah, that too. Although I remember correctly that here we didn't have the shirt for line con yet.
Unfortunately, no.
After, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, those kinds of shirts generally garner those kinds of conversations.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get to the Spot the Ballin for this week, which there we go. Got the link in chat. Got just a Java class here. It's HTTP servlet, has a do post inside of it. Starts off with just if not check auth, response.send redirect them off to the login page. Then it continues on with just try and upload a file. Does canonicalization on the file name. That gets that right off the so it's presuming it's a multi-part upload, so you're going to have your content disposition in the body, grabs the file name out of there. Creates a variable for the directory to upload into, canonicalizes the actual file name provided, tries to canonicalize it with the directory path you're supposed to upload in, make sure the canonical name starts with the directory that you expect it to be in. So if you have any traversals, it should normalize, make sure you can't do that. And then writes the file out. And unfortunately, a lot of people kind of got tripped up on this one, looking at this file upload code, looking for a directory traversal. But the vulnerability is right up at the top, check auth. The issue here is you're sending the redirect, but the code still keeps executing. You send that header, but it doesn't terminate the connection. It doesn't stop anything. So the file upload is still going to happen. All of this other code down here is still going to run. It's just after it runs, it's going to have this redirect header at the end. And your browser is going to hide the actual body of the page from you. But all of this code is still going to execute. So just an auth bypass or just bad code. It is the sort of thing that's a lot easier to detect dynamically if you're actually running the web app. Maybe set a breakpoint in there and then it's like, oh, you actually hit that code or you actually uploaded a file unexpectedly. A lot easier to catch it there, but it is a thing where if you're sending off on redirect, you've got to make sure to terminate execution.
The funny thing is, I think if the Spot the Ballin was a PHP challenge, people would have caught it a lot quicker. Because this, typically you see this kind of thing in PHP where you try to redirect the user and you don't die after. In Java, it's like, I don't know, I guess it just doesn't stand out as much. So yeah, I kind of missed over that too. It's easy to hone in on the, all the stuff with the path canonicalization and you know, get sidetracked on that.
So I originally wrote the Spot the Ballin and like all of this code just didn't exist. And then it's like very obvious what the issue is. And for those of you just listening, like all of the upload code didn't exist. It was just a check off. And then it's, you only have one thing to look at, but it's also kind of the reminder, like it's really easy to get distracted with the more interesting functionality and just gloss over that stock, you know, auth check. You know, you see that in all the functions or something, and you don't bother actually checking it and notice a change or a difference there.
Yep, it's very easy to tunnel vision and, you know, not even notice that code really or take a hard look at it. So, yeah.
Tunnel in on the more interesting code.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if somebody did find a bypass here, I think it was 10 in Discord, had some interesting insights when it came to some path differences on Windows versus Linux and stuff. But if you did have some, this is, as far as I'm aware, kind of the proper way to do it, canonicalize and check the prefix. But if you find a bypass, I would definitely be pretty curious about that, because there'd probably be a lot of places vulnerable if you could get around this one. Or I just wrote the code wrong. I have not written Java in a very long time.
All right, so we'll get into our topics. Up first, we have a follow-up post by Synactive on one of their pwn-to-own submissions for Canon printers, which unfortunately they collided with another team on, but nonetheless, they wanted to write it up. In the first post they referenced, which we covered back on episode 150, they found a buffer overflow in the CADM protocol, or Canon Administration Protocol. This time it's the NetBIOS protocol for facilitating various services like the name service and session service and such. And the parsing of the names is kind of where the vuln comes in. So according to the NetBIOS spec, which they go into a little bit and they have some diagrams here, names are encoded into two levels. The specifics of this are kind of weird, but essentially it takes a 16-byte name, expands it to 32 bytes for the first level, and then the second level contains a sequence of labels for the domain name, which consists of like a 1-byte header indicating the length, followed by the label bytes. So what's important is those sequence of labels. So yeah, getting into the vulnerability, they looked at the cmnetbios parse name function. And the problem is, if you specify a label with a length field of 0, the counting sort of gets messed up. Because if you look at the, so for those who are watching, you see like the second level encoding parsing, it'll just try to do the memcopy, but if you do a memcopy with a 0 length, it's just not going to do anything. It's going to be a nop, essentially. But it's still going to advance the destination pointer by 1 byte. So if you continuously pass these 0 length labels, you can get the counting out of sync, and eventually when you get to a valid label, it'll copy it out of bounds. So they get it to something like 255 bytes out of bounds by sending enough labels. So it's still an overflow, kind of like their first post, though it is a fair bit more complex in how it's triggered, and some more steps are needed. Whereas, because the first one was just like an unchecked length, this one's more of like a logic problem and just failing to handle the edge case of having a null label properly. To exploit this, it was pretty nice because they were able to overflow into adjacent internal name entry objects, which contain some useful pointers, including one to this adapter, which if you can fake it, ultimately allows you to get an arbitrary 2-byte write primitive when it goes to write a negative name query response. Getting into the specifics of that, I didn't fully follow because I'm not familiar with NetBIOS. You kind of have to be familiar with the different objects involved there to fully appreciate it. But yeah, essentially they're able to get an arbitrary 2-byte write, which is pretty powerful.
Sorry, go ahead. Really quickly, just mention, basically, I don't have a good understanding of NetBIOS either, but it does use it. It uses information from kind of both the corrupted information, the buffer that you're corrupting is where it's getting the address on where to write things. And then when you send in this, what was the name of that again? The positive name. Yeah, positive name query response. Send that in. When it's corrupted, triggers it over, does a negative name query, and it just writes the transaction ID that was in that positive one. It's like, hey, this is actually corrupted. Writes that transaction ID, writes that to the pointer that they're able to corrupt. I think it's kind of neat when it takes advantage of the data that you overflow it to get the address, and then you control the data through the packet that you send in. Just kind of a fun dynamic there when it comes to getting control over both sides of that write.
It's sort of a second stage corruption, yeah. So it's quite interesting how it works. But it does get into the specifics of NetBIOS, so there are some things I'm skipping over there. But ultimately, it is a cool bug. And like I said, it's unfortunate that they collided with another team on this one. Though, given the nature of the bug, I guess it's not super surprising. So, yeah, continuing on the relatively funny overflows, we have one in a chess engine. And I'll let Z get into this one because I think, Z, you're a little bit more familiar with chess than I am. I've literally never played it even one time. So I'm not even familiar with all of the terminology that's in here. I had to look some of them up. So I'll let you get into this one.
Yeah, maybe have a bit more. I'm not all that into chess, but I've played a little bit. I got into it back when the World Championship was happening or not world champ, the candidates tournament happening last year. Anyway, bug here, Stockfish. Stockfish is a chess engine, so it's one of the, I don't know if it's the top chess engine, but basically by a chess engine, all that is like the thing that like predicts what your next move should be. Is this a good move, bad move, evaluates the moves, and like very high performance, like chess bot, effectively. Chess engine, it's basically like your chess bot. So performance matters. So this is an application written in C. Stockfish has been out for a while. Well respected, highly used. So having a buffer overflow in there is a little bit worrying because this does kind of underpin like chess.com uses Stockfish. And a lot of applications use Stockfish. So it has a lot of use cases. So the bug here is basically just an assumption that when it's doing its move generation, it will never generate more than 256 possible moves on a single board. And that limitation is kind of fair to think of because given the normal number of pieces on the chessboard, they can only move so many times. Like a legitimate board can never reach the point of generating more than 256 moves. But because you can just specify any position and have it start evaluating from there, you could give it a position that couldn't actually be reached on a board. That would be like the example here is they have like many, I believe the layout here, you can kind of see the position then, and then they give this layout here. It's basically like the entire border of the board is all just queens generated on the one side, just a bunch of queens, like more queens than you could actually have in a game. So it's an impossible position is what I really want to say, but you can generate more moves, which leads into this buffer overflow where move list, which is, I believe, just two integers. So I was looking into exploitability on this one because part of why I want to bring this up is they fought really hard against fixing this. The fix is just increase the number of max moves to be a bit higher.
Well, the proposed fix. I don't think this actually was fixed.
This was not. They declined to fix this because of the impossibility of like the board. They're saying you have to check that if you give it something bad, they're okay to crash. But like the argument going back and forth in here, there's one point where they're talking about, well, is this even exploitable? I'll give you, this is quoting one of the maintainers here, I'll give you some milestones so that your PR can be accepted. Prove that the data instruct move is fully manipulable so you can, like, craft whatever, do something, they say, so the user, make sure code is returned to a ROP chain reliably. Prove that RIP can be modified. But the one thing here, optional, prove that CET can be bypassed when the program isn't even compiled with CET. Like, on both sides here, or I guess on the one side, this guy, like, reporting it was not an exploit dev, not really all that familiar on that side. So I'm not surprised he wasn't able to exploit this one, but on their side, their defense here was very weak. I felt really annoyed reading the whole thing because it's like, this is something that's, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was surprised like how much discussion there was because I was trying to read through it and I was like, oh, okay, that's a lot of messages. And then I got to one point and I was like, oh, wait, there's a bunch that are collapsed because they were hidden. And then I expanded that and it's like, oh, okay. Like it was crazy how much like vitriol was going back and forth. I think the crux of their argument was, though, that because this would require passing in an illegal move set, that kind of falls out of scope, so to speak. Like they don't consider that an issue. That's kind of your fault for passing a bad input, which I don't know. Like I can kind of consider that fair, I guess. Like in an ideal world, you know, you would be handling any like illegal move set that's coming in. You would be doing it gracefully. You wouldn't just be allowing the application to crash. On the other hand, like how many situations are you going to be able to pass this sort of illegal move set to try to get something calculated? Like you brought up chess.com. Like, I don't know. Like, I haven't really used it much.
I don't think you would be able to do this. But there are other things. Like, there's a whole, like, anarchy chess thing. I don't know how exactly they're doing everything with that. It's a lot of like illegal moves. Well, they create their own pieces, and there's a lot of craziness involved there. But like there are places where people do play these odd rules of chess, and they're still using Stockfish to try and evaluate positions. There are people that, like, you know, you post a chess puzzle on Reddit, parse the image, and run Stockfish on it to see what the next move would be. So like there are cases where things may read it. Like Stockfish is widely used, so I feel like I'd expect them to have something stronger. That said, this is also a case where performance matters. Like, this is a performance critical thing. Stockfish is a competitor as one of the top chess engines, and part of that is how much computation are they able to do in a certain period of time to get their next move out. And like, in terms of chess engines out there, I'm not sure if Stockfish is number one or number two right now, but like, it is one of the top engines there. So I get kind of wanting to push back on not introducing something that would be a performance hit, albeit minor. They're just increasing the space, increasing some of the memory usage, but it is still a hit.
Negligible. I don't even think it would be much of a hit. I mean, I can't know for sure without doing some thorough performance testing, but I really don't think that increasing the max moves like such a small amount is really going to do anything.
Well, so it's max moves, but then it's max moves on every position. So as it goes deeper and deeper, say it digs down 50 moves. Now that's 50x the growth, plus whatever actual size. So 50 times whatever the actual growth is. So I think there can be some reason to think that there is a performance hit here. Like, it does make a difference in terms of how well they perform to even do this much. Although it also feels like if that were the case, like 256 is also pretty high for your normal board to be able to reach. So yeah, I kind of agree with you that I don't think it's really that crucial, but I can see an argument and don't have benchmarks either way. Nonetheless, I also want to talk about exploitability here, because for all this said, unfortunately, I don't think it is exploitable. I tried to look into this. Obviously, seeing people talk about a bug is like, Johnny, Jim Joe, AlphaZero, wasn't that on Go? Or sorry, he mentions Google AlphaZero as top dog, I'm pretty sure. I am just pulling off the chess engine championship thing here to take a look at who's on top. But I think AlphaZero was Go, was it not? Like, that was in chess.
I'm not even familiar with the name, so I don't know.
Yeah, so Stockfish is the top chess engine championship is, I believe they are currently on top of that. So just bringing that up here, I don't know what the best thing to look at for that is. Either way, Stockfish is, or I guess I was looking at the league here where Stockfish is there, but then there's the cops where looks like LC0, but then Stockfish won several here. Either way, the point is they are kind of up there. They're good. It's a good engine, and performance matters. This isn't just some random software. But I do want to kind of pull things back onto the binary exploitation and talk at least a little bit on exploitability of this, because unfortunately, I looked at a couple things. So as they're talking about this, like prove it's exploitable and stuff, I figured, hey, maybe I can see a pretty clear path here and, you know, get something out kind of quickly. Unfortunately, move list, or this EXT move, looks like it is basically a set of two integers. Unfortunately, it's two integers, but only the lower half of the integers ever actually get filled. Like, it does this really tight packing of all the bits and does this bit field for like all these moves, give little notes on what the move's doing, like what type of move it is, all this little information in there. And it doesn't seem like you would be able to craft like a full pointer with it. Like, the maximum value, one of the integers is a value, literally how much is this point worth for it to do weighing with them. And like, the max value was like 32,000, I think.
And so you wouldn't even really be able to do a partial overwrite, right? Because it would be padded.
Yeah, you would have all those null bytes in there.
Yeah,
so that's tricky. And to be clear, I did not jump into a debugger to actually check my assumption here on my, or my understanding. So I could be mistaken. But with that in mind, you're extremely limited by only being able to have zeros on the top half of the number.
Yeah, you basically be limited to 16 bits zero extended. If you're right, which feels a little bit tricky.
For it to be using like the bit field and then it's like not using all the digits there, like to only be using so few digits. Again, performance matters. So it does feel a little bit weird. So I'm willing to say, like, well, I'm always willing to say I might be wrong about this. But yeah, it felt a little bit off. And there wasn't any sort of structural data that looked like you'd be able to overflow. Because while the generate moves list potentially could overflow elsewhere, really it's only going to overflow or you're going to be able to generate that many moves. In just a couple of cases where it's generating like all of your evasive moves or whatever, if you're limited to only like your king needs to escape trouble or something, you have like this, they do move generation with kind of constraints like that. Some of them are to evade an attack or whatever. If you're limited to those, you're not going to have as many possible moves by its very nature. So only when it's doing all the legal moves, do I think you'd be able to get an overflow. Even then, you're generating moves. It's generating the moves that it wants. You don't have much control over that, so I don't know. It doesn't seem exploitable, unfortunately, and I kind of would have liked it to be just because of how they kind of acted in this thread, but yeah, unfortunately, doesn't seem to be, well, unfortunately for them, it's not exploitable, but unfortunately for the security research, nonetheless, it is an interesting move to think about, like, you know, if you have a program that is accepting a state but expects the state to be in a like legal or normal position. Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting place for the bug to appear.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I agree. I think the, you know, requirements to be able to exploit it, it's kind of a tall order. And you didn't even touch on like, you know, stack cookies and stuff, which I believe even the original report indicated they're not. Okay.
I don't believe
so. Like, it says with modern DEP and frame pointer security checks, it's unlikely this could be exploited to perform RCE or anything. So with that said, like, I kind of assume that stack cookies are in place. But I didn't look into it too much. So
they compiled this with omit frame pointers. I think there was a mention, maybe not of canaries. Oh, no, because canaries also feel like something that they wouldn't have for the sake of performance. Which I feel like there is somewhere in this chain where they talk about not having the canaries enabled.
It could be buried somewhere, because like I said, like there are hidden posts and stuff, and yeah, it might be hard to find. But even if you don't consider the canaries, like you said, it's already a tall order if you have those in place. Also, you know, it's made even harder, so yeah, I lean towards this probably being unexploitable. But, you know, in the very unlikely event that it is exploitable, it would be a very interesting exploit to take a look at, to say the least.
So let's say frame pointers are there, and I guess, like, this is open source, so you can build your own. So you can or not have them if you don't want. I feel like the default was not in there, but I can't find my source for that, so I could just be wrong. If you had frame pointers, though, I don't think there would be a way to exploit this. Because in the cases where you do have, in the case where you do have the overflow, there's like one pointer you might be able to hit, but you're going to have a hard time trying to craft a pointer using this overflow. But there's no like control data that you can really compromise. There's this state where it has like, you know, the last chain that it generated and you can go back on it, or previous state basically, that has a pointer, and that seems to be the only real target for any exploitation. Like there's no good metadata to corrupt that I could see. So yeah, rough to exploit, unfortunately. But I spent a long time looking into this bug. Maybe not that long, but I spent a while looking at it, so figured we'd cover it.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, like I found some of the back and forth interesting. I can kind of see a bit of merit on both sides. That said, I think the performance argument is... I just don't think it holds a lot of water. I think that's kind of a common excuse.
It is, and I'm not a fan of saying, like, okay, performance is worth the trade-off in most cases. The reason why I'm kind of at least okay with it... So, like, if this were a web server, you know, if this were Nginx or something, I'd say performance isn't worth the trade-off. Like, you should go for security. But specifically when this is a competitive piece of software and, like, the competition is about performance, like, that's where it does feel a little bit different to me. Like, it is a very specialized, a very specific case where I'm like, okay, I'm kind of okay with claiming performance here. But yeah, I'm generally not a fan of letting performance be the excuse.
Yeah. And actually on that note, something I meant to bring up earlier and I kind of skipped by in lieu of other stuff we talked about, the like original poster of this report had suggested a more, performance conscious solution as well, which was just to prevent generating moves for any position with more than 16 pieces for either side. Which again, like that would be fair because that's not a position you can reach from any normal game state. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a bit of an interesting situation, but ultimately, I think the solutions would be like fairly simple and effective here, but they just weren't implemented. So, can't go any further on that.
Yeah, and without actually having the benchmarks, that's another reason why I hate just rejecting on the case of like, oh, it's for performance, but that would actually have the benchmark to say performance would have been negatively impacted.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I don't like how they handled this, but they're open source. They're not a security product. It's a niche product. Yeah. They have a lot of kind of specialty things going on here.
And it's also, in many cases, probably not something you can trigger. And if you can trigger it, also probably not exploitable. So, you know, there's mitigating factors on the other side, too. But
yeah, like this wouldn't be exploitable on something like chess.com that I mentioned. Like they wouldn't, you wouldn't be able to create such a position there unless somebody found a legal position that could generate that many moves.
Yeah,
which doesn't seem in my head, like doing quick mental math doesn't seem possible.
All right, so we'll jump into our next post here, which is two vulnerabilities in VirtualBox, an out of bounds write and an out of bounds read in the TPM and BGA subsystems respectively. So they chain together quite nicely. Starting out with the out of bounds write, VirtualBox exposes the ability for guests to use the TPM or Trusted Platform Module. And so if that's enabled, it'll emulate the memory mapped IO for the TPM, which is at this hex FED 40,000 region. The MMIO handler on the VM side will take the number of bytes accessed in the region as the CB value. And the problem is on the MMIO read handler, they kind of just assume that the CB value is 8 or lower, thinking that a user is only going to, you know, read or write a keyword at max. So they just have like an N64 for the CB value. And yeah, they just mem copy the attacker controlled command response into the 64-bit end on the stack. So if you use some special instruction that does more than an 8-byte access, so think like AVX512 on CPUs that have it, or in this case, x87 support, and the FXR store 64 instruction, you could get 64 bytes written and get a 56-byte out-of-bounds write of seemingly fully controlled contents. Now, of course, there is ASLR, and this is where the out-of-bounds read comes into play, which is in the VGA module. Again, there they looked at the MMIO read handler, which would use a guest-controlled address to index into the VGA frame buffer. And while it tried to check if the address was within the size of the frame buffer, it wouldn't consider that the array is being accessed as like a UINT32 array. And so the index is actually 4 times the address, not just the address. So the checking isn't really sufficient there. Somewhat common issue to have when you're not considering how you're indexing into your arrays. I think I've seen a few of these types of bugs before, especially at like DOS level.
We've covered this sort of thing before. I'm pretty sure it was even to spot the bone at one point. I mean, part of it's also just the casting. If you do the casting, like in this case, when you're converting the whole thing into the N32 pointer, rather than maybe taking your, although your result would only have the 8 bytes then. I like this bug quite a bit, just because of the fact there is the size check there. At a glance, you might not think much of it because they do check the size, but ultimately that size is just the wrong value to check. Well, done incorrectly, basically.
Yeah. So that gives you the out-of-bounds read. Exploiting this was a little bit trickier than the author hoped for, since the heap layout is fairly unpredictable. You know, it is virtualization. It is going to be doing a lot of complex things. So the heap shape will change quite drastically between runs. So they did have to apply some heap shaping here. For heap spraying, they use the host-guest communication manager message call object, which you could spray quite freely by just like invoking service calls. And it's also a pretty nice object too, because it has a vtable pointer. It also is like a doubly linked list, so you can leak both heap addresses and code via the previous and next pointers, as well as that vtable. From there, once you have ASLR defeated an IP hijack, it's a matter of wrapping it. They do go into some details on the tail end of the post about optimizing their exploit and getting into some Windows-specific tricks to try to improve speed and reliability. I'm going to skip over that mostly here, partly because it's so specific to Windows, partly because I don't have all the background information there to cover it properly. But that information is there if you want to check it out. Whenever you see these, you know, memory corruption and virtualization, it is interesting to cover. Something that I think should be, that I do want to call out here, is the fact that the first vulnerability with the out-of-bounds write, TPM being exposed is like an opt-in thing. You do have to have it enabled, which it seems like it isn't by default. So that is a bit of a mitigating circumstance. I don't really know how often you would want to be exposing the TPM to the guest in this way. Maybe there are some scenarios, especially in enterprise. So I don't want to, say that kills the chain completely in terms of how useful it is, but it is a mitigating factor. It's neat to see these two vulnerabilities and how well they can chain together. And VirtualBox isn't one that we cover quite as often. Usually, we do have the focus more on like VMware and especially like Parallels Desktop. But
yeah. Parallels lately, VMware quite a bit, because they actually are worth something to have a bug in. VirtualBox isn't damn, quite as. Shade. Well, I just mean like you look at something like ZeroDM or something like that. VMware. I don't even think they'll pay for VirtualBox, or it's like a completely lesser tier. Was this Pwn to own?
I don't think so. Oh, yes, it was. Yeah,
this was.
Yep. Pwn to own Vancouver.
So Pwn to own, at least, so ZDI is paying out for it. I guess ZDI pays out for whatever. But it's part of Pwn to own, I guess. It's giving reason to. I don't think. No, VirtualBox has been part of it. I feel like they've disappeared for a little while.
I think there might have been a point where they were taken out because it was being hammered on so much. Sort of like...
couldn't afford it.
Sort of like what they did with Ubuntu, where they were like, oh yeah, we're not taking anything except for kernel stuff now. I think it was kind of a similar situation. I might be misremembering, but I think you are right. The thing with VirtualBox is just, I don't think it's as popular in enterprise as VMware is. It's kind of seen as like the budget. Like if you don't go with VMware, you go and because like you can't afford it or it's not in the budget, you go with VirtualBox. Like it's kind of the second choice of most people.
Hyper-V too, which I mean, if you're already in the Windows corporate environment, Hyper-V is usually there already on your Windows install.
Yeah. Rudimal mentioned maybe if directly mounting an encrypted drive or something. Yeah. That could be something, but I think you would probably use like shared folders or something for something like that. So I don't know. I'd be curious on how much it's used.
I could imagine other case for like you just want to have DRM accessible over it, like a level 2 DRM or whatever. Just want to have that available inside of a VM. That would then require hitting the TPM. So I could see reasons to expose like TPM like that.
Yeah.
Through the virtualization. So there are reasons for it. We don't have stats. you know, go into the details on how common it is. But it was enough that, like, it was part of Pwn.tone. Like, Pwn.tone allowed it or had that as their default. So it was at least they set up they were willing to pay out on.
Which is a fair point. Like, that does hold some weight to it. So, yeah. And yeah, like, even though VirtualBox isn't used as much as perhaps some of the other virtualization clients, you know, it is used. Like, it's definitely not a, you know, nobody's ever running this software. And VM escapes are always, you know, impactful because it's a big part of the threat model for virtualization. So,
I mean, VirtualBox, so at the very least, with that being open source, you can build on top of it. So I could imagine more on, like, the, I don't know for sure, but on malware analysis side of things, building tooling on top of VirtualBox, perhaps, making it a bit more used in that sort of environment where you actually want to do more than just have virtualization, like do more than just use it as a tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, kind of extending on it. I could see that for sure. But yeah, ultimately it comes down to these two vulnerabilities, just poorly implemented MMIO read handlers. It seems to be somewhat common. We've covered a few posts with memory mapped.io. The ones that come to mind are like the CTERT PS2 emulator escapes. They were based on MMIO handlers being faulty. Seems like something that's maybe not looked at as much, or just the code quality isn't there compared to like other systems that have been hit more. So I think
we've covered a VGA bug too before.
Yeah. So memory mapped.io is definitely something to keep in mind if you're looking for somewhere to target with virtualization. It seems to be a problem point for various different vendors, not just VirtualBox.
It can definitely be challenging, like regardless. Like it is just kind of a little complex area.
Yeah, and one that not a lot of people look into because it's not super fun to deal with. So, yeah, with that said, we'll get into our last vulnerability here, which is out of Project Zero in KGSL. Z, I'll let you get into this one.
Yeah, and this one's, honestly, it's just a fun little bug. Security impacts may be a little bit questionable. We'll get into that. But this deals with an Adreno or through a KGSL bug. Qualcomm Adreno being like their GPU. So they have two virtual address space. They have their underscore user address space and they have the underscore secure underscore users, kind of your global map, all of your global mappings, process private data is going to be in there. When you issue the GPU instructions readable out of that address space. But then the secure one is kind of where you have all of your DRM protected, like all the DRM protected pixel buffers, which is kind of the thing that matters here. Although a user can indicate if they want some particular allocation to go into either the user address space or into the secure address space using just a flag where they make the allocation call. They provide this memflag secure flag. Providing that flag, it'll allocate it into the secure area. And the problem is that basically the secure area is shared by all of the processes. Everything's getting shared inside of there. So a user space, which also can just write commands out directly, like there's no validation happening on the commands. Commands are just in a shared memory buffer. GPU reads it, user space writes it. Kernel doesn't need to get involved there.
To be fair, there is some filtering, but I don't think it's super relevant for this case. But yeah.
There is, so I want to say this depends on how you're going for your access. If you're going through KGSL versus using Adrenos directly. I think that's going too much into the details of how KGSL versus Adreno works. Because technically they are different drivers. KGSL is like this higher level, the support layer, SL support layer to using Adreno. It kind of passes things along. Anyway, the whole vulnerability here is that a user space being able to just issue their own instructions, their own instructions there, can just issue basically a write to any of the secure buffers and start corrupting or overwriting data in any of the other secure pixel buffers. Which then means that, or that's kind of where you run into the questionable security implication here. They use the attack of, I believe they call it tap jacking. If I can type.
They do, yeah.
Yeah. Saying, like, they could draw, potentially, you know, overwriting the pixel buffer, they could draw, like, some other system UI or draw over system UI to trick a user into tapping a button and do something there. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a fun little bug just because that aspect of, you know, they're sharing the space so the user consequently can access any of the buffers, not just those that are their own. So kind of a fun issue, but security impact's kind of low here. Tapjacking, like, you've got a kernel bug to social engineer somebody.
Yeah. And Qualcomm had determined that this was a won't fix, so they don't consider it security. I think they use the term NSI, no security impact. So that's why this one was released, even though it was won't fix. It's just Qualcomm doesn't really care about it, which I guess kind of is a fair stance to take. There is the nuance that you have to be able to have like a secure context, and there has to be like, you know, DRM content visible on the screen. It's going to be limiting on when you can even use this, and then you also have to factor in that ultimately this is like a complex social engineering attack. So, you know, do you really care about that so much? I don't know.
Yeah, and actually I feel like it would be hard. I'm trying to think of an exploitable scenario where it's like you want them to take some action. You need the DRM stuff on screen because that's what's going to end up in this secure pixel buffer is stuff that's DRM protected. So you'd need an application that's playing like DRM media, like Netflix or something, and then you'd want a single button click while that's playing that you can like override. I'm having a hard time imagining a scenario with DRM. Like, I don't know.
It's a stretch, for sure.
Yeah. It is an interesting bug, though.
Yeah, I was just about to say, it falls into that unfortunate category where it's a cool bug, it's cool how it works, but ultimately the security impact is, it boils down to, like, social engineering, right? It's similar to a bug that we covered recently with being able to inject into SE password. You might be able to pull off a social engineering attack by making a sysadmin think you're a privileged user when you're not, but you know, the amount of times you're going to be able to take advantage of that is going to be pretty small, if ever. It's unfortunate. It's probably the first won't fix bug that I've seen out of Jan Horn in a while, I must say. It's pretty interesting in that way, but you know, I kind of see Qualcomm's perspective on it. I think it is a fair stance to take, but it doesn't take away from the coolness factor of the bug. Taking advantage of your access into these global buffers, you know, it's cool. It's taking advantage of more of a design flaw type issue. So
yeah, and that's, I think, a lot of what we've been seeing out of Jan and in Adreno lately has been that sort of issue, which is really neat to see.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so getting into some of our shoutouts, there was some information posted on Rep to ASLR, basically another like speculative side channel type attack. We didn't really want to cover it fully because there's some stuff I don't really understand about it, to be quite honest. So basically they take advantage of leaking pointers to the branch target buffer. And the way that kind of works is they're able to collide their BTB with another processes and use like an attacker gadget to try to, you know, speculate on what that address is that's being returned to. It's quite complicated. They do lay it out in this document here, and they also have a public proof of concept code. One thing that I don't really understand why this works is I don't know why the branch target buffer isn't flushed on a context switch, because like other buffers that are similar to this, so like the translation look aside buffer, for example, that gets flushed on a context switch. I don't really know why the BTB isn't. But for whatever reason, because it isn't, you can create this scenario where you can, defeat ASLR by trying to leak these return addresses. It's kind of interesting how it works. I don't know how, like, usable it'll be. It's going to be somewhat specific to your attack scenario if you're able to use this. Though it is less limited than some of the previous attacks. Like, I think they say it's more practical than a Ret Bleed, because that kind of requires you to have a gadget in the victim process, whereas this doesn't. Yeah, there is some interesting details here. I don't fully understand how it works, so that's why we're not doing full coverage on it. But it's something to be aware of. Maybe it's something you can, you know, throw in a chain with other issues or something. So definitely didn't want to ignore it. But it's somewhat complicated with how it works, and I don't understand all the subsystems that are in play with making it work. So
yeah, worth a shout out. But like you, I mean, it's kind of getting more low level than I am comfortable with. Getting into all the kind of CPU stuff at that. But it is interesting to see, as they call it, kind of the reverse Spectre. Well, the reverse Spectre BTI-like scenario. You know, kind of fun to see people just taking a different approach on the old bug. I mean, it's not that old. It's just a few years. But on that bug class, too. Basically target attacking yourself rather than attacking a victim process.
Yeah. Our other shout out is around Apple and their failure to fully reboot iOS simulator copyright case. I believe this is around Corellium. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, this so, is the we talked about Corellium. We talked about this case quite a while back. I feel like it was I think it was a few times. Yeah, and I feel like one of the last times would have been like September, maybe a year ago. I guess it wasn't last September, so yeah, it would have been September before that. I feel like we talked about it. Anyway, basically, I feel like finally the case isn't really getting revived. They've kind of said Corellium, you know, wasn't copyright infringement to build up their emulator for like security testing and all of that. The reason why they say they failed to fully reboot this one, because where they did leave it is like the iOS assets, like images and like the phone background, could be copyright infringement, but that is such, I think, a side issue from like the core thing here about like iOS. That while they did say like lower courts should review the infringement of like those images, I'm not a lawyer. My guess is like that's an interoperability thing because they don't have the degree of control if they're using iOS signed and all of that. To just change that, it's necessary for interoperability. So like, they get a pass, but that it, I'm not a lawyer, and obviously some judges decide somebody else should review it again. So there's that aspect, but it is such a minor part of this case. And like the key thing is that Corellium's basically okay to keep going with their iOS emulator.
Covered under fair use. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that argument with like the image assets and stuff feels like such a cope argument where it's like, oh, we couldn't win that. Okay, let's try to win something.
This was the judge coming back saying that Apple's claims that that should go to the lower court. So the judge was basically saying, like, hey, this area still may have merit, but we're not deciding that.
Yeah. Did just want to bring it up because we have talked about it before. You know, as per usual with legal cases, they're pretty slow moving. So it's been a while since we've talked about the Corellium stuff. That said, it will be in the show notes, and we'll link it in the description to our discussion on that. Don't want to rehash over it all here because there's not really any new information on the front beyond the fact that it's kind of, over. So yeah, wanted to shout out that it's been concluded, but check out that previous discussion if you're interested in some of the nuances on that. And again, you know, as we always like to say when we bring up these cases, it is mostly just our opinions on it. We definitely don't have any legal expertise, it's been an interesting case for security research as a whole, because Corellium is a super useful tool for doing iOS research. It's sort of like necessary because of how Apple is with keeping their devices locked down. Being able to simulate or emulate iOS in that way is extremely useful for iOS research. So it was pretty important that it was able to hold up against Apple's attempts to take it down. So
yeah, not even like iOS research against iOS, though it has its use there. It's definitely useful on like bug bounty and like the higher level, just doing things on iOS applications because of the level of access you get to the device.
Yeah, application security testing is also boosted because of, they have like a debugger and everything. So very useful set of tools. So yeah, with that said, I believe that's everything that we have for the week. So unless you have any parting thoughts, see, we'll wrap it up there.
No more shout outs.
All right. So as always, thanks goes out to everyone who tuned in. If you want to go back and check out past episodes, you can find recent ones on Twitch and all of them on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more links off Anchor. Feel free to join our Discord and follow us on Twitter. Links for those are down below in the chat as well. Like we said at the top of the show, feel free to shoot some ideas in the Discord or DM them to Z for the Spot the Volume shirt stuff if you have some thoughts on that. And we'll see you next week for our last week of the podcast before the summer break.